Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
The high cost of going green. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Google is investing $94 million in solar plants in Northern California, but will other companies follow suit? California's leading the nation in dealing with climate change, but that's driving up the cost of electrical power. Will higher energy costs drive new investment out of the state, including the money needed to fund more alternatives? Also tonight, Countrywide, now owned by Bank of America, will compensate minority homeowners for racial discrimination. Later on, Bradley Manning and government secrecy. First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. PFC Bradley Manning may get life in prison for releasing almost 750,000 classified documents. Later, we'll hear about Manning's pretrial, WikiLeaks, and the classification of information that poses no risk to national security. First, Countrywide, now owned by Bank of America, has agreed to what the Federal Justice Department calls the biggest settlement of its kind, $335 million to compensate for racial discrimination in lending. Countrywide, of course, located still in Calabasas. Charlie Savage reports for the New York Times. And Charlie, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the details of the settlement.
So this settlement covers lending discrimination practices by Countrywide from 2004 to 2008, the height of the housing bubble years, and that was before Bank of America bought it in the late 2008. But Bank of America has now agreed to pay an absolutely massive settlement, $335 million, to take care of these allegations. The previous record for a fair lending case was about $6 million.
Wow.
The historical nature of this in context. This came to light in 2007 when the Federal Reserve was looking at data about loans made by Countrywide and first noticed that there was some statistical disparities where black borrowers and Hispanic borrowers were paying higher fees and getting worse rates than white borrowers who had identical credit histories, so the same qualifications. And they referred the matter to the Justice Department, which after the Obama administration took over and started putting more resources into its fair lending examination of the Civil Rights Division, worked up this study, and it discovered that more than 200,000 minority borrowers across the country had been victimized by these practices, and additionally, they found about 10,000 had been steered into subprime mortgages when they actually qualified for regular mortgages.
And I take it from your story also that white borrowers with similar credit profiles didn't get subprime loans.
That's right. Well, so this is all based on statistics, but minorities were more than twice as likely to be steered into a subprime loan when they actually qualified for a regular one.
Well, when you're talking about 200,000 minority borrowers and they make this massive settlement of $335 million, are they actually going to compensate all of the people that were discriminated against?
I guess that's the idea, and there's going to be some very complex analysis of who should get what out of this settlement. It's not everyone will get the same amount. I think that they said at the press conference the people who were steered into subprime mortgages when they should have gotten a regular loan will get more, but I think that the borrowers will see between several hundred and several thousand dollars each.
And I understand that they actually sought black and Hispanic borrowers. Why did they do that?
I'm not sure that they actually sought them, although Countrywide was certainly expanding into neighborhoods that had not previously been as well served by banking, because this was at the time when Wall Street had enormous demand for subprime loans. It wanted subprime loans, not regular ones, because this was the height of the frenzy of bundling these together and then reselling them as bonds, which sort of led to the financial crisis. And so Countrywide was making as many loans as it could and wanted more subprime loans so it could sell them at a higher price to Wall Street. And that was the sort of backdrop of the froth years of the housing bubble. What happened was that Countrywide's procedures set a basic rate. If you have a credit history of this and you're trying to borrow this much money, here's roughly what you should pay. But it allowed its brokers and its employees to alter those rates without a lot of supervision, And it turned out then that its brokers and employees were giving worse deals to minorities than to white applicants with identical histories on a sort of massive scale.
Is the Justice Department looking at other lenders?
It is. It has it's settled or filed lawsuits in about 10 cases so far, and it has at least that number open and still looking at them.
Okay. Once again, a countrywide look at it in Calabasas, now owned by the Bank of America. Charlie Savage with the New York Times. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with Which Way L.A.?
For more information about Which Way L.A. or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayla. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Ollie back with Which Way L.A. Since 2007, Google has offset its own greenhouse emissions by paying for projects that do that job elsewhere. But Google concedes that its data centers use massive amounts of power and says it's disappointed it can't fire them up with more renewable electricity. So now it's investing in wind farms and solar power. It's spending $900 million, $800 million this year alone. Most recently, $94 million for four solar energy farms to serve Sacramento's municipal utilities district. Parag Chokshi speaks for Google's clean energy team. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks.
Tell us more, and these are going to go online pretty soon.
That's right. These projects are going to be completed next year, and I should clarify that we have a wide range of clean energy initiatives at Google, and we do offset our own energy use in a couple of different ways. The first, we focus aggressively on energy efficiency. And we've been doing that for a long time. It saved the company about $1 billion over the course of our history. And our data centers use about half as much energy as the industry average. And the second thing we do is we try to use renewable energy as much as we can. And we've done that in a few ways. We've got some on-site solar. We've got an on-site solar installation here. I'm at our headquarters in Mountain View. And we've also been procuring renewable energy for our own operations. And so we've signed two deals to do that, and we're about 25% renewable today. And then, of course, as you mentioned, we do offset our energy use with high-quality offsets. But the investment that we made, coming back to that, is a slightly different. We're also investing capital in the sector, because we think it makes business sense, and there's a commitment to help the space grow, and so that's where this project comes in, this investment comes in, and as you noted, we're now at about $915 million invested with this latest.
When you buy renewable energy in California, does it cost more than regular fuels and oil and gas?
Sure. So the energy that we've procured for our own operations, actually it's two wind projects in Oklahoma and Iowa. And, these are long-term PPAs. We think long-term at Google, and we're going to be around for a long time. And so we signed 20-year deals, 20-year, what they're called, power purchase agreements. And, it makes a lot of economic sense for us because, the fact of the matter is that the cost of fossil fuels is only going to go up as time goes on. It's a finite resource, and we expect that that cost will increase over time. And what these 20-year long-term deals have allowed us to do is get a fixed cost for that energy, and it's renewable over that 20-year period. So it allows us to plan better, and we think in the end it'll make economic sense for us over that 20-year time frame.
Parag Chokshi, again, spokesperson for the clean energy team at Google. It's the Public Utilities Commission that approves contracts made by utilities with energy providers. A recent report by its Division of Ratepayer Advocates says that the state's emphasis on renewable sources will drive up the cost to utilities and their customers as well, and it recommends that cost containment receive priority in what the PUC does. Dan Walters is a syndicated columnist with the Sacramento Bee, and he asks if higher rates will ultimately drive private investment out of the state. Dan Walters, good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
What's the argument?
Well, California already has the nation's ninth highest electric utility rates, retail rates, and a little over 13 cents a kilowatt hour. And the some indications coming out of the PUC, which I wrote about in my column this morning, a report from their Office of Ratepayer Representation, a kind of an internal ombudsman, indicated that the PUC is putting on great pressure on the utilities to sign these renewable contracts that are mandated under state law. Under state law, and new state law signed by Jerry Brown, they have to have 33% of their power from renewables, that's his solar, wind, or geothermal, by 2020. And so the PUC is putting pressure on the utilities to sign these contracts, and this ratepayer office says that they're doing these contracts even when they're way, way above the market rate of utility rates, which is around 10 cents a kilowatt hour. That's the average of what utilities pay now for power from conventional sources such as gas-fired turbines, and predicts that this will manifest itself when these renewable sources are actually activated and the utilities start paying for these contracts that they're signing, will manifest itself in substantial rate increases to customers' utility bills. And so the question I postulated is whether if our utility rates, which are already, like I say, the ninth highest in the country, go up substantially more, it could become a big damper to getting the kind of private investment in job creation that California so sorely needs with 2 million unemployed. And it would be kind of ironic, as I point out, tragically so, if we couldn't get solar panel plants to locate in California because our low-carbon utility rates were so high. And that's the kind of question I think this whole thing raises. You know, California is in an economic crisis right now. There's some signs of improvement. We're still mired in terrible recession. We have the second highest unemployment rate in the country. And we need a lot of investment to do something about those million-plus jobs we've lost in this recession. And the utility, it's only one of many factors, taxes, regulation, all sorts of things. But it's one of those factors that could make it difficult for California to compete for investment in the years ahead. Now, the governor and other advocates of this policy say that in the long run it'll pay economic dividends in terms of California becoming a center of alternative energy. But that may or may not happen. I don't know. All we know is that in the shorter run, at least, our utility bills are going to go up pretty substantially, maybe 25-30%, to pay for this conversion to a less carbon-oriented electric power grid.
Dan Welders again, syndicated columnist with the Sacramento Bee. Mary Nichols is chair of the Air Resources Board, which has just completed a cap-and-trade program that puts it way ahead in getting California into the renewable energy area. Mary Nichols, good to have you on our program. What do you say to what Dan Welders says? It could be a tragic irony of trying to have more renewable sources generated in California because of costs that might drive investment out of the state, including investment by people who want to build renewable energy facilities.
Well, the world is full of bad things that could happen, but the facts as we know them today don't indicate that this is a likely scenario. I think the reality that we're seeing right now is that California is at the forefront of attracting investment from companies like Google that want to see more renewables put into place. There is a potential that the utilities will ask for rate increases, but that doesn't mean that they get them. It's up to the Public Utilities Commission to decide whether they deserve those rate increases to be passed along to the consumer or not. The job of the Division of the Ratepayer Advocate is to advocate solely on prices for consumers. They don't look at any of the other issues, including job creation or benefits to the state. That's not their business. All they care about is what the rate is. And by the way, although Dan's number in terms of the rates in California is correct, this is kind of an old canard because the fact is that California consumers, California residents, do not pay such high rate increases. They're actually about average for the country because we use less electricity, and we also have managed over the years to reward conservation so that businesses and individual residents use less electricity per person, per unit of output. We have a very efficient economy, and because of that, our bills are not actually higher. So this is not just potential or theory that we're talking about here. We're seeing dollars coming into California to build new renewable energy facilities, and they keep on coming because the demand is here. And I think that's what we have to focus on. It's really not a question of a trade-off here. It's a question of the benefit that we see in being ahead of where the rest of the country and in some cases the world is going in terms of these technologies.
Let me go back to Dan Walters with the Sacramento Bee. A lot depends on perception. If people think that they're paying higher rates than they are or paying more for electricity, whether they use more or less or not, are people going to be unhappy about this, do you think? Are you looking at this from a political standpoint?
Well, I think people will be unhappy when they see their power bill goes up, regardless of what they're paying now. And a lot of that has to do basically with California's very mild weather. But here's my point. If you have a given facility, an industrial plant that may employ 1,000 people, let's say, for example, making solar panels or making anything, for that matter, tires or anything, and you look at that in terms of costs, and you know how much power that plant's going to consume, regardless of whether it's in Mississippi or California or in Wyoming or wherever. And if that power is going to cost you 50% more here than it does, say, in Texas, by the way, our power rates are 50% higher than Texas rates, then that becomes a factor in your decision. And it's not isolated factor. It's on top of a lot of other factors, including wage costs, regulatory costs, taxes, and everything else. And it is one of those elements that goes into deciding any state's business climate, the ability to compete in a global economy. And I'm just saying that in this particular case, this is going to send power rates up.
Well, let me go back to Parag Chokshi with Google. You're in the business of the world of business. How do you respond to what Dan Walters says? If you can locate for half the cost of power in Texas, why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of considerations. I mean, the cost of power is just one of them. You know, Texas actually is one of the largest producers of wind in the U.S. I think the way we see it, energy rates are going to continue to rise. The cost of fossil fuel is going to continue to rise. And that's why we've signed deals to procure renewable energy for our own operations. I should make another point, which is that, we've seen a dramatic decline in the cost of solar over the last 2 years. Solar panel prices have gone down about 70% over the last 24 months, and so there's great growth in this sector. And if you look, over the long term, I think the IEA, the International Energy Administration, says that the global demand for energy is going to create a $26 trillion industry over the next through 2020. So there's a great business opportunity here for the state of California. We've invested $915 million, and of that, this $94 million that we invested just yesterday is in California. We've also invested in the BrightSource Ivanpah plant in California and the Alta Wind Energy Center in Southern California as well. So we've seen great opportunities.
Speaking of public perceptions, let's turn to Werner Chabot, who is CEO of the California League of Conservation Voters, calls itself the nonpartisan political action arm of California's environmental movement. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You've done a poll recently that might shed some light on the acceptability of rising costs of power to the voters and people who, of course, have to power their homes. What have you found?
Well, a couple of things. One, it was our education fund, our C3 arm, and we just completed this major poll of the values of declined estate voters. These are the independent voters who declined to be identified as Republicans or Democrats. They're about 20% of the California's electorate, and they're the fastest-growing voter bloc in California. And they're going to be very important. We look at 2012 is going to be a watershed year, election year in California, because with kind of a trifecta of term limits, open primaries, and redistricting, these declined estate voters are going to be engaged in the June primary. And we wanted to know, what are the values of these voters? And the bottom line is that this 20% of the voting bloc that's going to be a major swing vote in June are the independent voters. They're also conservation voters. They're solidly pro-environment. They support a wide range of conservation policies that protect air, land, and water. For example, we found that two-thirds of them consider themselves to be conservationists. They agree by a 2-to-1 margin that climate change is occurring. It's a major problem that needs to be addressed. So they're going to be responsive to creative solutions that look at renewable and better forms of clean energy in California. When asked about their opinions on environmental regulations made by our lawmakers, almost 70% believe that environmental regulations provide an important benefit. So the bottom line, again, is that the poll shows that if you're a candidate running for office in California and you strongly support tough laws that are going to protect our air, land, and water and bring us clean energy, you're going to win over this key block of voters. So if candidates want to win in the June primaries, they should look at these independent voters and recognize that they support strong conservation values that include the types of clean energy policies that your previous speakers have been talking about.
Sometimes when you ask people if they're willing to pay more for things that they find desirable, however, the numbers go down. Did you ask them that?
We did not ask that question, but what we did find was that, like I said, by a 2-to-1 margin, they considered themselves strong environmentalists and want to support strong policies. So even if you add in the cost factor, we think that still is okay. Going to provide a strong majority support for the type of clean energy and renewable energy policies that your speakers have been talking about.
Dan Walters, you've been on many programs of our programs talking about the independent voters and how important they are. Might this poll suggest that the increased energy cost could be less of a factor with them than you otherwise might have thought?
Well, I would feel better about it if they actually asked that question, whether you're willing to pay X amount of money, 25 or 30 or 50% increase in your power bill to pay for this, but obviously that question wasn't answered or asked and answered. I would say this. First of all, my column wasn't about the effect on voters. It was a question about
sure.
economic competitiveness. But I think it's kind of ironic that while we disparage the emergence of this two-tier economy in California and the division of wealth between an upper class, an overclass, and an underclass, we seem to be willing to impose higher costs on the underclass in a couple of different forms. Number one, higher utility bills that they would have to pay out of their low incomes. And secondly, less competitiveness, economic competitiveness, that could make it easier for them to get a job and join the middle class or the upper class.
Okay, let me go back to Mary Nichols on that one. Again, Chair of the California Air Resources Board.
I'm kind of shaking my head here at the moment because California has very progressive electricity rates for businesses and for households, and the lowest class of the lowest income class of consumers are really subsidized by the wealthy. That's the reality of how our system works. There are many people on lifeline rates and then others who pay very, very minimal rates. And the largest consumers and the largest businesses are the ones who get socked with the highest bills. That's, in fact, the way our system works. Putting in more renewable energy is going to create more reliability for the system overall and give people more access to affordable energy than they have today. There is a capital cost for building new plants. There's no question about that. But older plants are being retired and moving offline, and these new facilities that are coming in are being financed by private sector capital that's helping to create jobs here as well as the future for people in the state of California working in the industries that produce the equipment and supplies. So I think Dan Walters just has it plain backwards.
Okay. Let me go back to Parag Chokshi with Google. What about Solyndra, which recently went out of business? It was a solar panel maker in California, which found that it wasn't able to make it, went bankrupt.
Yeah, no. So I think, in that situation, and I don't know the specifics of Solyndra's business, but what I can say is, as I mentioned before, we've seen a dramatic decrease in the cost of solar, and we're really seeing grid parity in a lot of for a lot of technologies in different geographies. And so in some ways, actually, the fact that Solyndra wasn't able to compete in this environment is a testament to the competitiveness of the solar industry and the success in driving down costs, which is, of course, great for consumers.
Wasn't it also technological because Solyndra was making a more expensive panel than the Chinese?
yeah, I mean, part of it was technology, but you know, we're seeing that as you reach scale in this industry, costs are declining, and of course, part of that is deploying larger projects, and that's something that we're trying to do with our investments.
Okay, a lot for our listeners to think about. That's all the time we have. Thank you all for being with us. Parag Chokshi, again with the Google, Mary Nichols, chair of the Air Resources Board, Dan Walters, syndicated columnist with the Sacramento Bee, and Werner Chabot of the League of Conservation Voters. Good to have all of you on our program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page in a moment. Bradley Manning and Government Secrecy on Which Way LA. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. In a preliminary hearing at Fort Meade, Maryland, PFC Bradley Manning's defense rested today after calling just two witnesses in 35 minutes. Military prosecutors called 20 over 4 days and rested their case yesterday. Manning faces a possible court-martial on 22 charges, including aiding the enemy, a capital offense, for giving tens of thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks, which published some on the Internet. Josh Gerstein is covering the hearing for Politico. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. Good to be back with you.
This was pretty quick, 35 minutes, two witnesses. How come it was so abbreviated?
Well, you know, the defense had wanted to bring all kinds of witnesses into the case. I don't remember the exact number, but I know that they were in the dozens. I think somewhere around 40, perhaps, and ranging all the way up to President Obama himself and the Secretary of State. They were claiming that the president was relevant to the case because he made a public comment some months ago that Bradley Manning had broken the law, suggesting that Bradley Manning was guilty. And, of course, he's the commander-in-chief. So that was something that they thought could affect the way the military handled this process. But the defense's witness requests were more or less rejected by the investigating officer here, who said that he thought a lot of them were not relevant to the decision he has to make about what should happen in this case.
So what kind of defense was mounted during that 35 minutes?
Well, I mean, the defense began much earlier than that 35-minute exchange. We've heard the defense over the last 5 or 6 days as they've cross-examined government witnesses, and indeed, I think 10 of the witnesses the government brought forward were people the defense also wanted to bring forward. But there's basically two lines of defense here, primarily. One is that Bradley Manning, this private who was fairly young, 21, 22 years old in the Army at that time, was in such a state of emotional turmoil regarding personal and mental health issues that he had. He said had sent an email to a superior saying he was suffering from a gender identity disorder. He was thinking about having surgery to change himself from a man to a woman. He sent that same officer a photograph of himself in women's clothing. He was also having emotional outbursts where he would either be non-responsive, kind of catatonic when people tried to talk to him. One time he was curled up in a fetal position on the floor, and in a couple instances he either screamed and yelled at the top of his lungs, flipped over a table, and in one case actually punched a female soldier in the face in a manner that was, she says, was totally unprovoked. So the one argument is sort of there were ample opportunities for the Army prevent this disaster from happening, and the Army didn't take them. The second line of defense argument, anyway, was that the way classified information was being handled by this Army unit in Iraq was so derelict and so reckless that Manning might have somehow gotten the idea that it was okay to share information however he wanted. There were soldiers watching videos, movies and such, listening to music on the classified computers. There were supposedly CDs that may or may not have contained classified information strewn all over the place in this facility, which is called a SCIF, which is supposed to be used to make sure that classified information doesn't escape, that nobody comes in that doesn't have a clearance, and no information goes out unless it's documented and it's going out for an official reason.
On the other hand, the prosecutors have introduced evidence they say shows that Bradley Manning knew exactly what he was doing in passing on the information and even thought that he was some kind of whistleblower.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of evidence, frankly, that he was responsible for the leaks. I mean, that's one of the factual issues here. You know, indications on computers that Bradley Manning used, that he had been searching for Julian Assange, the name of the founder of WikiLeaks, that he had searched for information about WikiLeaks and the kind of information WikiLeaks was looking for, that he had downloaded certain files, that he downloaded some of these diplomatic cables, that he might have been trying to encrypt them or package them in such a way that he could send them through the Internet more easily. So there was a fair amount of incriminating evidence on the basic facts that Private Manning was responsible for this leak, and as you say, also that he knew he wasn't supposed to share classified information with outsiders. It's part of the basic training that I think most soldiers get, if not all, and certainly he was an intelligence analyst, so he'd gone through training about what all the different kinds of classified information are and who should have access to them, and indeed all the soldiers that were asked at the hearing said that they understood whatever violations there might have been in watching videos and the wrong computers and so forth, that they certainly weren't allowed to release classified information to outsiders.
Wasn't there some contention that he had bragged about it?
There was indeed a contention that he had said first in chat logs with this hacker, Adrian Lamo, who ultimately turned Manning in to the FBI, that he had said he was responsible for releasing one of the videos, one of the sort of airstrike type videos that WikiLeaks put out. And he also made comments to other people in his unit, to one particular soldier, saying, if people knew everything I was doing, I would be out of the Army, you know, in a flash or something along those lines. So there are some indications that he knew what he was doing, and maybe even that he covered his tracks, maybe erased some data, and so forth. So it's not like there was no incriminating evidence here. There was a fair amount of evidence indicating that if somebody in that unit is the one who released this information to WikiLeaks, it probably was Bradley Manning and not somebody else.
Was there information at all about whether or not what he had released endangered the United States?
There was really very, very little testimony on that. And in fact, the testimony that did come out, I would say, didn't really make a strong case for that. The defense was able to bring out witnesses who said, well, these situation reports from the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, their first-line, front-line reports sent by soldiers, you know, moments after a battle or an incident, sometimes they're not revised at all. They're often largely inaccurate, and they're pretty fleeting in their significance. You know, I think they were released perhaps 1 to 6 years after the events in question. There were also, you know, there have been these reports that names of sources that worked with the United States military were in there and could have been released and caused those people to be threatened or killed or what have you. And the soldiers who testified said, you know, names weren't supposed to be in those types of reports at all. And that when they were so generic often that it would be pretty tough in Afghanistan, a place like Afghanistan, figure out which person they were talking about. And I didn't see the prosecution really present any evidence, really, of the damage that these disclosures could have done.
Considerable embarrassing information, including the video you mentioned, which showed an American attack on people who turned out to be journalists on the ground.
That's correct. There were a couple of Reuters journalists that were fired on and killed, I believe, by this
right.
Apache helicopter. So there was a lot of information that, as one of the soldiers said, didn't make the military look very good.
Okay, so closing arguments tomorrow. What then does the investigating officer have to decide?
Well, yeah, this is a little different from your sort of traditional civilian court procedure. This investigating officer has to decide basically which of the charges, there's 22 charges against Manning, ranging up to aiding the enemy, which is a potential life sentence or death penalty offense, all the way down to, you know, disobeying an order. And all those charges, he has to sift through them, see which, if any, should be sent forward to a full court-martial, or potentially maybe if the case should be decided at a more reduced level with some kind of administrative punishment or kicking him out of the Army. But I have to say most of the experts, military justice experts that I've spoken to, have said when the Army charges a case so seriously, like this aiding the enemy charge, the notion that they'll just, you know, slap Manning on the wrist and send him along is unlikely, and most folks I've spoken to believe that officer will recommend a full court-martial, which is effectively a full trial for him.
Prosecution has indicated they probably won't ask for the death penalty, but they might ask for life in prison.
They have said they won't ask for the death penalty. Life in prison is the maximum other punishment, and it's at least technically possible
okay.
that somewhere in the process someone could decide the death penalty is still on the table.
Well, Josh Gerstein, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Okay, Warren. Happy to do it.
Again, reporting on this preliminary hearing for Politico. Jesslyn Radack is a National Security and Human Rights Director at the Government Accountability Project. That's a whistleblower protection and advocacy organization, and good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Is Bradley Manning, from what you've seen, a whistleblower?
Well, under the Military Whistleblower Protection Act, theoretically, he is. It protects, that law protects a military member who makes a disclosure that he reasonably believes evidences illegality and abuse. So I know you just characterized the Apache helicopter video as embarrassing, but according to that video and chat logs that have been attributed to Manning, he certainly had more than a reasonable belief that what he disclosed evidenced illegality and war crimes.
So were there other potential war crimes that were also involved?
Well, certainly, I mean, a number of things in the State Department and some of the chat logs evidenced things that could technically be characterized as war crimes, and technically under international law, if you don't report those things, you yourself could be implicated in war crimes. I don't think, unfortunately, I mean, I don't think the Whistleblower Protection Act is not going to help him here because it doesn't provide an affirmative defense. He does meet the classic whistleblower definition, and the Military Whistleblower Protection Act is not very specific about to whom you should make your disclosures. And I think what we're bickering about as much as the disclosures is the medium through which he made them, namely WikiLeaks. And the Whistleblower Protection Act for the military doesn't give clear guidance regarding to whom you should raise your concerns.
Cliff May is president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. That's a Washington-based think tank that deals with national security issues. Cliff May, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be with you.
Is this man a traitor, and should he be prosecuted to the maximum extent of the law?
Well, it's two different questions. I think he deserves to be prosecuted. I think whether or not he's a traitor, that may come through in the charges, and whether or not he's convicted. I think the basic concept here is not too complicated. He voluntarily chose to join the military, to wear the uniform. He voluntarily chose to go into military intelligence. In military intelligence, he learned he had an obligation not just not to release classified documents, but to protect classified documents. He violated all of that. And, there have to be consequences for such a thing. Now, how severe those consequences are, that's what's going to come out, I think, as a result of these hearings, and will be decided what he is charged with. It sounds to me that like he is certainly no hero, as his supporters are making him out to be. I disagree that he's a whistleblower. He may not be a traitor. He may be what his defense says, which is a young man who is rather emotionally disturbed and who is in an environment in which classified information was not being handled, protected as well as it should have been. That may resolve him of some legal culpability, but certainly no moral culpability.
What about the Army itself and the way it's treated him as you indicated yourself, the kind of environment that he was in? To what extent did they facilitate and, if not encourage, at least let happen what he's accused of doing?
Well, I mean, if I understand correctly, when the charges of mistreatment are since he's been arrested, not when he was a soldier working in military intelligence on these computers and downloading, and this is an important part of it, literally hundreds of thousands of field reports and State Department cables, most of which I have to believe he did not even read. Now, if he's been mistreated since he's been captured, that's serious. P.J. Crowley, who is a former State Department spokesman, somebody I know fairly well, State Department spokesman under the Democratic administration, he publicly criticized the Pentagon for its treatment of Bradley Manning, and I take PJ seriously. But PJ Crowley also draws a distinction and says this is not a matter of whistleblowing, not when you're talking about hundreds of thousands of unread documents and simply pumping them out to somebody like WikiLeaks and Julian Assange.
Jesslyn Radack, what about the fact that he released so many documents, any one of which might have had information that would be dangerous to the United States? How do you respond to that?
Well, the danger to the United States is part of the Espionage Act analysis and aiding the enemy. But in terms of the Whistleblower Protection Act, motive doesn't matter. why he did this, and volume and numerosity of documents or in your disclosure doesn't matter. It's not part of the calculus and whether or not you get to be a whistleblower. The government does not get to make the determination of whether you are a whistleblower or not.
Jesselyn Radak again at the Government Accountability Project. Gene Fidel is a teacher of military justice at the Yale Law School. Professor Fidel, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here, Warren.
You have written that Julian Assange is really the ghost at the banquet here. What do you mean by that?
Well, forgive the Shakespearean reference, but the point is that in a way, this case is really about him rather than Manning, because it was, I'm taking some things that I've read in the papers as truthful, but you know, the notion is that it was Mr. Assange and WikiLeaks, which he was and I guess still is the head of, disseminated around the world. So there's a sense in which he's the big fish and Manning is the little fish.
But the government can't get at the big fish.
Well, they can't get at him in a U.S. court-martial, and I think the Department of Justice is probably burning the midnight oil to find out if he has bumped into some other provision of federal law that might cover him as a non-resident alien.
So at the moment, he is in England trying to avoid extradition to Sweden, which has indicated that it might in turn extradite him to the United States.
That's right, and I guess the latest legal development is that the UK Supreme Court has agreed to hear his case. So it's going to be a little while before we know whether Mr. Assange is going to be continue to be a guest at some country house in the southeast of England or a jail cell in Sweden.
How important is the issue of whether or not the information did real damage to the United States or to sources of information or damage of any other kind?
I'm going to be really bad. I'm going to give you a lawyer's answer.
Important. Why would you suspect? You're a professor at Yale Law School. You're entitled to do that.
It's important and it's not important. There are some provisions of law that make that a pertinent consideration, and there are other provisions of law that simply deal with how you maintain and protect classified information. And those violations are merely a question of complying with regulations, and the end result is immaterial. Now, the sanctions for that are less draconian, but it's still a serious matter.
Because, once again, there could have been information there that would do damage, and as was pointed out by Cliff May, it's unlikely that he was able to read all of those documents.
Look, it goes to the integrity of the government's program, which is a pervasively regulated program for protecting the country's secrets. Now, does the country have too many secrets? Undoubtedly. This case makes me think that the country has too many people with access to classified information. And frankly, that's one of the things I've been scratching my head about.
Another question is whether there is too much classified information in the first place. Liza Goitein is co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. And Liza Goitein, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you for having me.
So you're going to give us a lawyer's answer, too, I imagine. But you have argued, and it's perfectly reasonable, but you have argued that one of the things that comes out of this, whether it reflects on Bradley Manning or not, is the fact that so much inconsequential information ends up being classified.
Sure. And when discussing WikiLeaks, I think the public and the media tend to focus on Bradley Manning and Julian Assange and whether and how they should be held accountable. And as you have said, you know, to me, that focus misses the bigger picture, which is the epidemic of overclassification in the federal government and the need for accountability on that front. The WikiLeaks documents, they contain some information that could harm national security. I don't question that. But they are also filled with information that should never have been classified. And you have to ask, what is the effect on someone like Bradley Manning, who is constantly exposed to documents that make a joke out of the designation of classified? The obvious answer is he and others in his position are going to lose respect for the system, and that loss of respect is a recipe for leaks. So it's a national security problem.
You're not arguing, though, that Bradley Manning is a hero or a whistleblower?
I think my position on Bradley Manning, if in fact the allegations against him are true, is probably somewhere in between Jesselyn's and Cliff. I agree with Cliff that I don't think he really could have read all of these documents, and he certainly could not have assessed them thoroughly enough to say each of these documents, you know, reveals something the public has a right to know and it won't harm national security. So I don't see this as a classic whistleblower situation. I think it was incredibly reckless. But on the other hand, I think intent does matter. It matters under the law. And I think it matters morally, too. And I think that's where I differ from Cliff. You know, it doesn't appear that he had any intention of harming the U.S. or helping our adversaries. So in that vein, I think some of the charges that have been brought against him and the sentence being sought are really overkill.
Back to your point about some of the information making a joke out of the whole classification system, one example you use has to do with a U.S. diplomat's observations of a wedding someplace in Russia. Will you tell us more about that?
Sure. A U.S. diplomat stationed in Russia attended a wedding in the Russian province of Dagestan, and he reported on the wedding. His cable was classified paragraph by paragraph, so he had to make a determination for each paragraph what the classification level should be. And in the paragraph that describes a typical Dagestani wedding, things like the wedding takes place over 3 days, that information he deems to be confidential, meaning that its release could reasonably be expected to harm the national security. And it's that kind of thing that really gives classification a bad name.
Cliff May, back to you with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. With the wedding and other things presumably similarly trivial for classification purposes, what about the argument that Bradley Manning might well have lost any kind of respect for the system? And is the Army itself then and the whole classification process somewhat responsible for what happened?
Well, I think the reform of the classification process is probably called for. I'm just not sure that greatly mitigates the responsibility that Manning had. If he thought that his assignment as a military intelligence officer was kind of stupid and it didn't make much sense, then there are things you can do, people you can complain to, or you can try to get yourself discharged, other things. I think the point is this, that the military, and this is why, much as I love the Shakespearean reference, you can't say this is really about Assange. It's more than that. No military, not the U.S. military either, can simply say, well, you know, we wish our intelligence officers wouldn't steal and dump our secrets. And when that happens, you know, we're going to insert a very strongly worded letter into the file. I think they have to do more than that. And the idea that he either thought he was doing something good, I understand criminal intent has a meaning, but at the end of the Cold War, you had moles in both the FBI and the CIA. If Robert Hansen and Alger James had turned the information they were gathering over to Pravda rather than the KGB, or to Julian Assange, if he was around then, would that have made them whistleblowers? Would that have made them not guilty of anything? Were we wrong to see them as people who were harming American security? I don't think so.
Liza Goitin, back to you. What are the motives for over-classification?
It really has to do with the incentive structure that's built into the current system. There are multiple incentives to classify documents that have nothing to do with national security. There's the scandalous motive to conceal incompetence or wrongdoing. But there's also a host of more mundane motives. There are turf wars between agencies and bureaucratic infighting. It's faster and easier to classify documents than to actually sit and think about whether or not there's a national security risk. There's the threat of punishment for not protecting sensitive information. And then on the other side of the scale, there are basically no disincentives to classify information. The process of classifying is quick and easy. The classifier is not required to even identify the national security harm that could result from disclosure. And there's no accountability, which is really the big issue. In theory, agencies can impose sanctions on officials that overclassify. In practice, they have no motive for doing that. And in fact, they have no reliable system in place to even identify people who overclassify. So there's simply no accountability, and that's why it happens.
Jesselyn Radak, would you say that this in any way mitigates what Mr. Manning, PFC Manning, is accused of doing?
Well, I think it goes to the question that is at the heart of some of the more serious charges under the Espionage Act and aiding the enemy. Because if you, Aldrich Ames and Robert Hansen's names have come up, but the U.S., I mean, under those laws, under Espionage Act, you need to articulate that what he did harmed the United States or benefited a foreign nation. And I have not heard any detail about that, as Josh Gerstein had pointed out. And we did not hear any detail about that in any of the other spate of Espionage Act cases that have become all too popular under the Obama administration. Those are key elements. Those elements were drafted onto, they were grafted onto the Espionage Act by Judge Ellis in the Rosen-Weissman case. So it's a pretty, those laws are meant to go after spies, not whistleblowers. And he, what he does is not classic spying. And we can have an argument on whether or not, how classic or not it was of whistleblowers. I don't know how much people have actually dealt with them who are speaking to this issue.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this program. Thank you all for being on our program. Cliff May with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Jesselyn Radak with the Government Accountability Project, Gene Fidel, who teaches military justice at Yale Law School, Liza Goitein at the Brennan Center at New York University's School of Law, and our earlier guest, Josh Gerstein with Politico. Good to have all of you with us. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Christian Bordahl with Caitlin Schamberg and Karen Radziner, our technical director, Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla or join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.